talk on a specific application of these new lattice constructions to the problem of quantum gravity, specifically three-dimensional quantum gravity written as a Chern-Simons theory. And then I'll give you, I'll just conclude. All right, so why bother? We would really like to have a non-perturbative definition of what you mean by supersymmetric group. Okay, something which is defined outside of expansion and Feynman graphs. In the same way that lattice QCD, in the limit where you take the lattice spacing to zero and the number of points to infinity, gives you some sense of rigorous definition of what you mean by QCD. So you'd like something similar in the case of a supersymmetric theory. You hope, when you have such a construction, that you can do things like strong coupling expansions, Monte Carlo simulation, and new kinds of tools will emerge which will allow you to extract non-perturbative physics. So the obvious thing you'd like to understand, and which is hard to do analytically, is to study things like dynamical supersymmetry breaking. So that would be kind of a sort of field theoretic motivation for what we want to talk about. And then, of course, there are, in recent years, all these connections to quantum gravity have come up in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence and similar holographic correspondences, which, in principle, we can make some connection to once we know how to do things like n equals 4, in some sense, exactly on the lattice. And there are also additional connections I'll tell you about today, which appear in the case of at least in three dimensions. All right, so why isn't everybody in the lattice community doing supersymmetry, since everybody else has been doing it for many decades? The problem is that usually supersymmetric theories are extremely difficult to study in discrete form. And the reason for that is obvious, and it was known, it's been known for a long time. And people, there are papers on supersymmetric lattice field theories right at the very early days of lattice gauge theory, in the early 80s and late, even late 70s, I think. None of those early approaches ever got anywhere. And the reason is simply that the supersymmetry algebra is broken automatically, usually, when you discretize a theory. As soon as you don't have an infinitesimal generator of translations, then you're violating the supersymmetry algebra up front. And that typically means that you induce lots and lots of SUSY violating operators in your effective action. All right. There's an equivalent way of thinking about it in terms of the Leibniz rule. When you start naively discretizing an action, replacing derivatives by finite difference operators, what you'll find if you just try to follow that path is you will not be able to reorganize terms together into total derivatives as you would in the continuum, because the Leibniz rule doesn't work when you replace derivatives by finite difference operators. So in general, that failure of the Leibniz rule is how you would see it operationally if you try to just brute force a discretization of a supersymmetric field theory. Okay, so what happens is you get all these SUSY violating terms that appear in the action. There are many of them typically. And the subset of those SUSY breaking operators which are relevant, that is, have coupling constants which vary like an inverse power of the lattice cutoff, those have to be fine-tuned as you take A to zero in order to get back to a supersymmetric theory. So if you don't do any fine-tuning, your continuum theory will flow away from the supersymmetric fixed point. It will not be supersymmetric at all as you take the cutoff away. So in practice, this fine-tuning business is very hard, because typically there are a large number of these operators, so hard it's impractical in most situations. There are a couple of the cases where you can try to do this tuning, but in most situations you can't do it. It's also kind of unnatural that you have to work so hard in order to define a supersymmetric theory once you've discretized space-time. So there's something sort of unnatural about the whole business.
So question.
Yeah.
So you're saying it's worse than breaking the Lorentz
invariants? Yes. Well, right. There are even it's right. In the case of Lorentz invariants, you maintain typically, if you're on a hypercubic lattice, you maintain some discrete rotations and translations. And those are sufficient to prohibit the relevant relevant Poincaré violating operators that would come up. But in the case of supersymmetry, you naively don't have any discrete subgroup that will help you, will prohibit some of these operators and allow SUSY to emerge as an accidental symmetry in the long wavelength limit. That doesn't occur typically in supersymmetric theories. So it's much worse than breaking Poincaré invariants. Right. So the solution, and this is like the final slide in some sense, at least of the first half of the talk, is this. So you can twist the theory, and I'll tell you what that means in a minute, to produce one or more nilpotent supercharges from your original supersymmetry algebra. What you'll find also is that the twisted action typically takes a sort of a Q-exact form. So the action of the theory written in these twisted variables will be Q on something. So as long as you discretize the theory maintaining the nilpotent property of Q, then S is going to be trivially invariant under this one supercharge. Now, if you also, so that turns out to be relatively straightforward. The subtlety is how you also choose this lambda in such a way as you can preserve gauge invariance if you're doing a Young-Mills theory, and also avoid problems like fermion doubling, so that you have the right number of fermions in the naive continuum limit. So I'm going to tell you how this works in a couple of the cases, and focusing on n equals 4 in particular. But this is really, we're at a point now where an enormous amount of work has gone on over the last 5 to 10 years by a lot of different people, many more than on this list, actually. And so we now kind of understand how this works. And there have been a couple of different approaches to this problem, which started off in very different areas. They were very different in their orientation, but we've essentially produced a unique set of lattice actions at this point. So there are no other ideas floating around. The actions I'm going to tell you about are the unique actions that seem to work that preserve some element of supersymmetry in a Young-Mills theory. So if you want to learn more about it, you should look at this physics report with David Kaplan and Mitad Unsel for more details from a couple of years ago. All right, so I'll show you how this works. Okay, so let's start off with just a two-dimensional Young-Mills model. It's a very simple model with just 4 real supercharges. So if you want, it's n equals 2 in the old language in 2 dimensions. So this has 2 Majorana fermions transforming under, we're in Euclidean space, so an SO2 associated with the Lorentz symmetry, and there's an additional SO2 of flavor, so I can rotate the 2 fermions into each other. Actually, this model has an additional global SO2, but we don't even need it for this argument. So I'm just going to concentrate on this SO2 flavor and the SO2 Lorentz. So these spinners carry a flavor index and a Lorentz index. And so the theory is invariant under this set of global transformations. I take the original spinners, I act on them, say, on the left with a Lorentz, Euclidean Lorentz transformation, and a flavor symmetry on the right. But then if I focus on this diagonal subgroup with L equal to F, then what you see is this is the transformation law of a matrix. So I can consider the fermions in this theory under this diagonal subgroup where L equals F as a 2x2 matrix. So that's going to be the most important characteristic which allows us to twist the theory. Okay. So we're not going to focus on the full symmetry group of the theory, but just on this diagonal subgroup. Under the diagonal subgroup, I can treat these set of spinners as basically forming a matrix. Once I have a matrix like this, then I can decompose it on products of gamma matrices. Here, just Pauli matrices. So I can expand this matrix on the unit matrix, the sigmas, and sigma 1, sigma 2 in the case of 2 dimensions. So what you see is that the original spinner fermions that were living inside of Psi, you can think of just stacking the spinners together in columns, are now represented in terms of this field eta, this field Psi I, and this field chi mu nu. So what happens is that those original spinners now appear as antisymmetric forms in this particular representation of the fermions. Okay? And this is the essence of twisting. So the first thing you see for twisting is that you don't deal with theories involving spinners, you deal with theories written in terms of antisymmetric tensors. Okay? They're still anticommuting, but they're antisymmetric tensors. And the key observation, really, from the point of view of supersymmetry, is that one of those fermions is a scalar, eta. Okay? Associated with that eta, they'll turn out to be a scalar supercharge. Okay? It's a scalar under this twisted rotation group, which is a combination of L and F. Okay? So when I do a rotation in the base space, I have to accompany it by an equal rotation in the flavor space in order to expose the supercharge. All right? So it's a very funny combination of the original spinner components in the theory for which you can write it this way. Okay? All right. So what about the bosons? That's the story for the fermions when you twist the theory. What about the bosons? Well, the gauge field is a singlet under flavor, so it remains a vector under this twisted rotation SO2, this twisted rotation group, which is this diagonal subgroup of SO2L and SO2F. Now, the original theory also had 2 scalar fields. It had n equals 2 supersymmetries. It had 2 scalar fields as well.
So it's a singlet because you're looking at U1?
Sorry?
You're looking at U1
only? I'm looking at U1. Oh. This is a global symmetry. What there are 2 SO2s actually in this, but I'm only using one of them in. So I have a lot. Sorry, this doesn't mean left hand. This means Lorentz. So it's the SO2 Euclidean Lorentz symmetry, and one of the SO2 flavors. There's actually another SO2 in the theory. We don't even need that. Okay, so this is the SO2 prime. This is the twisted rotation group. This is how we're now going to decompose all our fields under this twisted rotation group. That's what it means to treat the fermions as a matrix. So the original theory had two scalar fields, and they were in the vector representation of this flavor group. They transformed into each other as vectors. So under this twisted group, you pick up a new vector, B mu, under the action of the twisted group, coming from the original two scalar fields. All right? So we have a vector under the SO2 prime corresponding to the original A mu, the gauge field, and now you pick up another vector, B mu, coming from the scalar fields. And in fact, what happens in all the cases where these models have been constructed on the lattice, and it's true in the continuum, of course, is that, in fact, in this twisted theory, you can repackage all the bosonic degrees of freedom you have in terms of complex gauge fields. So these scalar fields become the imaginary parts of a complex connection. Now, the gauge invariance will be the usual gauge invariance, but everything I write down will be a function of curly A. So I'll be writing down things like curly F, the usual field strength, computed on curly A. So all the bosonic action will transform into a simple function of curly A. All right? So all the scalars disappear inside of these complex connections. So let me show you exactly what it looks like in this case. So this is my two-dimensional theory I started with. All my fields are in the adjoint. Okay? The action is, of course, something to do with 1 over g squared, the coupling constant. It's q exact, so here's the q. Here's the lambda. If you want that gauge fermion I wrote down before formally, it's written in terms of one of the twisted fermions here, another twisted fermion here, and then D is an auxiliary field that you put in to close the algebra off shell. And here's the explicit action of the supercharge on the curly A's. All right? So when Q goes on acts on curly A, you get this psi mu, this vector fermion that appears. That is a singlet under Q. A bar is also a singlet under Q. And chi transforms into the F bar, okay, with an extra minus sign. So it's easy to see that Q squared is zero on all those fields. That's trivial. So Q squared on A mu is clearly zero. Q squared on psi is clearly zero. Q squared on A bar is clearly zero. Q squared on chi is Q on F bar, which is zero because Q on A bar is zero. So this is a nilpotent transformation which acts on these fields, which are the fields I just showed you arose after twisting. And these derivatives are just the natural derivatives. So curly D is a D plus curly A. D bar is D plus A bar. Okay? And F is just the commutator of the two curly Ds. All right. So to convince you this is exactly this usual theory, just repackaged in a different way, I can integrate out this auxiliary field. It was just quadratic. And I can do the Q variation. And when I do that, I'll pick up this form of the action. So it'll involve FF dagger, FF bar, a term involving d bar d squared, and then this is what happens to the fermions. So the fermions occur in this sort of geometric combination. If you're familiar with things like the Kähler-Dirac equation, that's essentially what we've derived here. Okay? So the fermions always come as components of a Kähler-Dirac fermion in this language. Okay? So notice the action is real and positive definite, even though it involved complex fields. And the fermions have disappeared as spinners and now just appear as antisymmetric tensors in the theory. So this notation here just means that this is the antisymmetric derivative on psi. Okay. So it naturally contracts with chi. Okay. All right. So this is still not obviously the original theory yet, but I can simply do a couple of integrations by parts. So I can expand F and F bar in terms of the usual F plus some derivatives on B. I can do an integration by parts, and I can show that this collapses to the usual Young-Mills term, a piece which looks like B box B. So that's like a scalar kinetic term if I interpret the Bs now as just ordinary scalar fields in the untwisted theory. You get the quartic term you'd expect in an extended supersymmetry. And then you get a fermionic piece, which comes from these two pieces here. Now, I can just, by brute force, assemble spinners out of the original twisted fermions. So I can put psi 1 and psi 2 together, chi 1, 2, and eta over 2 together, and just look at this antisymmetrized operator in here and write it out like this, where these are ordinary covariant derivatives, and I've exposed the B directly. So I'm now writing curly D is ordinary D plus IB, where B is the originally the scalar field. And so what you recognize is you have a Dirac structure for the fermions, and then these Bs correspond to Yukawa couplings. And in fact, these are precisely the right Yukawa couplings that occur in this N equals 2 Yang-Mills theory in an untwisted language. So all what I'm doing here is demonstrating this fancy way of writing this theory does indeed just embrace the usual theory you know about in flat space. I mean, in flat space, the twisting has no physical significance. It's simply a relabeling of variables. The reason we pursue it here is because it allows us to discretize the theory while keeping some supersymmetry exactly. Okay? Does anyone have any questions?
All right. Your Q seems a little unusual in that it's complex. Does that do anything at all? No,
I don't think so. You're in Euclidean space, so all the fermions are sort of in principle complex anyway. So that is a manifestation
well,
of that.
Fermions
I think.
Can be complex.
The fermions.
But usually Q is not. Usually it's real. In most theories.
Well, okay, so there are two. So I showed you the decomposition of the fermions into an eta, a psi, and a chi 1-2. There's a single field, which is the antisymmetric 2-form, essentially. So the same thing is true for the supersymmetries. There's a Q mu, and if you want a Q 1-2. But I can take the Hodge dual of the Q 1-2 and build another supercharge if you want Q bar. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening is that Q and Q bar are the linear combinations of the original Q 1 and Q 2 you might write down in the usual theory.
Right, and what does Q bar equal?
Q bar would be the Hamiltonian, something like it, I think, in this mm-hmm. language. Right, so Q squared is zero, so it's not the Hamiltonian. But if you combine those two different Qs, then you would get to something like the Hamiltonian.
There's something I never understood about these Dirac Kähler fermions. Mm-hmm. So I could just mention here, maybe you can answer or not answer it, which is that it's the behavior under 2-pi rotation. The spinner changes sign under a 2-pi rotation, but a 2-form does not. So
right.
How do you reconcile
I've always assumed that was to do with the fact you're not talking about one fermion here, but several fermions, right? Two in this case.
So
the Kähler-Dirac equation doesn't describe one spinner; it describes multiples of spinners, right? In this case, two.
So you need an even number of
yes.
fermions.
Yes. So I guess that's the obvious explanation. So there are two of them changing sign, and the particular combinations are such that there's no net change in sign.
It also changed sign with 2-pi rotation.
So you can find the 2-pi rotation.
Yeah.
That's
exactly Right. Okay. All right, so let me just make a few comments. This Q that appears here, of course, is very reminiscent. In fact, the whole structure of this twisted theory is very reminiscent of BRST gauge fixing. And that's not a coincidence, and you can derive these theories by gauge fixing some underlying topological bosonic theory, but I don't have time to go into that right now. It doesn't change the final result, which was our prime, the emphasis of this talk is what we can do with these things. But this is not a coincidence. It gives you a rather neat way of deriving some of these theories by a quantization, a Fadia-Popov type quantization procedure on an underlying theory with a topological shift symmetry, in fact. A bosonic theory. So in this case, the fermions would be the ghosts of that theory.
Norm states also?
Sorry?
You get negative norm states in
the ghosts? No. I mean, via the usual BRST procedure, you can project out the negative norm states if you're considering only topological observables. Right. So it's actually interesting that, in fact, if you have a Q-invariant operator in this theory, then you can show its expectation value in the usual way is independent of the coupling constant, because it's like a gauge parameter now, in fact. And it's also independent of the metric. So there's a subsector inside of these twisted theories which is entirely topological. The expectation values are metric independent and coupling constant independent. That's actually quite useful when you construct lattice theories because it gives you some exact things strong coupling to compute to check that at least your code is working correctly. So from a practical perspective, this is useful. It also has some theoretical usefulness, which I probably won't have time to talk about today, connected with what people talk about the sign problem in lattice simulations. So this actually turns out to be useful for that in telling you there isn't a sign problem in this theory. However, it's important at the end of the day, while it has this topological sector inside of it, which is exactly computable, we want to not just focus on that sector, but treat this as a change of variables in the theory. So we want to consider the full supersymmetric theory, not just the topological sector, which is really just the vacuum structure of the supersymmetric theory. So we don't restrict ourselves in the end to q-invariant states. So we take this whole twisting procedure as just a giving us a cunning change of variables so that the final action we get to can be discretized whilst preserving some supersymmetry, one, in this case, supercharge. Okay. So it's just a way of reformulating theory in a way that you can discretize it without, whilst keeping some supersymmetry. And we're not going to just be concerned with q-invariant states. So I haven't yet told you how you put this on the lattice. So first of all, these twisted fermion fields, or twisted fields in general, typically don't just get assigned to sites on the lattice. So this is one square of some hypercubic lattice with a body diagonal. They typically are distributed out over the links of the lattice. Okay, that turns out to be very natural in the constructions I'll talk to you about, and it allows you to preserve gauge invariance in the end. So that's the key importance. So the eta's is just a site field. It's just a scalar, so that goes on a site. But for example, the U field will be associated with the link, and this U field also. Similarly, its superpartner, the psi field, will also be a link variable. The chi field is associated with this diagonal link. And the reason we chose that is that it has essentially the F12, I'm going to give you a definition of curly F in a second on the lattice, and that's naturally associated with the diagonal link. It's like a product of two links around the square. So it naturally runs from this point to this point, and hence along a link. So we end up distributing, when we go to the lattice, we have to put these things on links. All right, and so they'll gauge transform like links. They're all adjoint fields, so they would normally transform with two factors of G, the gauge transformation, but those G's are associated with different endpoints of the link. Just as they would, just as in an ordinary lattice QCD, your fundamental gauge field lives on a link and transforms according to its endpoints. The same thing is true in these situations, except now it's true for some of the fermions as well. Okay, so this is not a conventional discretization of lattice QCD, for example, where all the fermions would live at the sites. Here, the fermions naturally associated with links, except for eta, which is sort of the degenerate case. Okay, but other than that, you take the Suzy transformations to be exactly the same as the continuum. So I write down a set of lattice fields, and they transform under the lattice Q in exactly the same way they did in the continuum. What's more, a precise dictionary exists that translates these continuum derivatives to difference operators, gauged difference operators. Difference operators. So for example, I won't give you the general rule, I'll just give you one example. If I want to know how to differentiate psi mu, which is a link field on the lattice with respect to this covariant derivative here, I pre-multiply by one of my curly u's at psi mu at x plus mu, and then I subtract off psi at x, post-multiply by an appropriate u. Now, if I set the u's to 1, this is clearly just a difference operator. So if I switch off the gauge coupling, then all the u's are 1. This is clearly just a forward difference operator. That's why I call it D plus. What the nice thing about this is that both of these terms gauge transform in a very nice way. If I actually plug in, maybe I should just do this, except there's no chalk. Is there any chalk here? Oh, here, good. I've got some. Let's just take the first of those terms. It's sort of instructive. So a piece of this derivative looks like this. By definition, this gauge transforms dagger. Okay, so it transforms like a Wilson gauge link. And then this thing, by definition, it's a link fermion itself, so it transforms like its endpoint. So these go away, and the whole object transforms like g of x, oops, that was x plus mu to start with, so I missed something here. This was x plus mu dagger. Okay, so it transforms like a corner point to a diagonal point. So it transforms like a lattice two form. Okay. So it transforms covariantly under these lattice derivatives. The same thing is true for the other term here, this thing here. So both of these terms transform in a particular way under gauge transformations. In fact, they transform like an object with the indices mu and nu, as defined on my lattice, a lattice 2 form. Okay? That means I can contract things like this with chi mu nu, and they give me closed loops on the lattice when I take the trace. So I can take expressions like this and start inserting them directly into continuum expressions and maintain gauge invariance. All right? And if I just expand them out, if I just set u equals 1 plus a, okay, then what this is the normal expansion you would do to show the naive continuum limit. If I just plug that in, you'll see that this thing also collapses to a discrete difference operator, a derivative, plus a commutator, plus order the lattice spacing. So the lattice spacing is absorbed into curly A here. So so this is only accurate to order A. So it has the right naive continuum limit, and it transforms covariantly. Okay. So I can start constructing gauge invariant expressions on the lattice according to the usual rules by these kinds of derivatives. Okay. The f mu nu I told you about before, in fact, is just exactly d mu plus on u nu. So it's exactly this rule, and it's automatically antisymmetric in the indices mu and nu. Without any further ado, if you replace psi nu by nu nu, you'll find this is a completely antisymmetric expression for f. And it has the right naive continuum limit. It's not the usual definition of f using lattice QCD, but it's completely legitimate. There's a theorem which was proven in the early 80s by Jeff Rayburn, Yuse, and people like that, which told you if you had one of these actions written in terms of p-forms defined on a lattice, then you can avoid all fermion doubling problems if you replace any occurrence of d mu in the continuum in a curl-like operation, in other words, an exterior derivative, by a forward difference operator like this one, and any divergence-like appearance of d mu, the adjoint of the exterior derivative, as a backward difference operator. So if you do this consistently through your Lagrangian, you will be able to discretize it and produce no spurious fermion modes, no fermion doubles. So there's a well-defined prescription for replacing derivatives by gauge covariant difference operators, which allows you to construct gauge invariant expressions easily on the lattice. And those expressions will not lead to doubling problems if you follow this rule, which I don't really have time to explain, but it's actually this rule could be proven by results in homology theory, actually. It was proven a long time ago. We just picked it up and used it. Okay, so that was an example in two dimensions. So how does this work for n equals 4? Yeah.
Does this not work for chiral fermions or something?
Chiral fermions, I have multiplets of Majorana fermions here.
Yeah, I got it. Here you didn't have
fermions. Yeah, otherwise I would violate various other theorems. Yeah. 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 This construction only works for vector-like theories. In fact, it has, as you'll see, this construction only works if you have a multiple, if you have 2 to the, let's see now. In two dimensions, let's see now, you need 2 to the d real supercharges to play this game, which is equivalent to the counting of real components of a fermion. So you need 4 Majorana fermions in 4 dimensions, which is n equals 4. The tricks won't work. You won't have this matrix structure for the fermions unless you have that.
But also the theorem that you referred to about.
Right, so they were actually thinking more generally about writing down actions which were not just fermionic but bosonic as well. If you just took an action which is written in terms of exterior derivatives and adjoints of exterior derivatives, and you went to the lattice with it in some naive way, how would you guarantee you didn't generate spurious modes, not just fermion modes but bosonic modes? And then you can prove that this prescription satisfies that. Another way of seeing that is that this Kähler-Dirac action we're constructing, if I switch off the gauge coupling, I can map it one-to-one into the action for what is called staggered quarks or Kogut-Suskin quarks. So those things don't double in the same way that the Kähler-Dirac action doesn't double. So there's an intimate connection between Kähler-Dirac fermions and staggered fermions, which again was known from the early days of lattice gauge theory. And so that's another way of seeing these things don't exhibit any fermion doubling. It's not exactly the same thing as a staggered quark action, what I'm showing you, but if you switch off the gauge coupling, in the free level it is, you can map it one-to-one. You have to introduce a lattice with half the lattice spacing and map fields that are on links to site-like fields on the final lattice to make the mapping, but then it works. All right, so how does this work for n equals 4? And you'll see the argument is almost the same. It's almost precisely the same. So I take an SO4 subgroup of the flavor grouping for n equals 4, which is SO6. All right, I just need an SO4 subgroup, and I twist that with the Euclidean SO4 Lorentz symmetry. Okay, so which means that I basically replace the fermions by a 4x4 matrix. Again, I can expand that matrix out on products of gamma matrices and extract the p-form coefficients. So there's an eta, a psi, a chi, and then these are things which you can think of as this is a 3-form and a 4-form, but I can dualize them back into 1 and 0 forms. So these are the fermions that would make up naturally a Kähler-Dirac field. When you look at the bosons, you have the original gauge field survives as a vector. The original set, you had started off with 6 scalar fields originally. What they break up into a 4 and a couple of scalars. So 4 become imaginary parts of a connection, a B mu, and then there's a couple of scalars floating freely still at this point. Okay. So this is the twisted theory. This twisted theory was originally written down by Marcus in the mid-1980s. It's one of the 3 inequivalent twists of n equals 4 from a topological field theory perspective. So it's the only one we can deal with, actually. But what's actually kind of cute about this is, in fact, this field content and this twist can be really compactly expressed as a simple dimensional reduction of a 5-dimensional theory. So I can take my original 16 fermions, hit my twisted fermions, and just repackage them as a 1, a 5, and a 10, which looks like they live in 5 dimensions. And the 10 bosons, that is the 6 scalars and the 4 gauge fields, can be packed up as 5 complex gauge fields.
Do the other twists leave you with some spinners?
So the others typically leave you with some spinners, right. And those are the problem from the point of view of the lattice construction. Right. So you have to remove all the spinners. You have to twist all the spinners into integer spin objects in order to apply the lattice construction. So the continuum field theories are well-defined, but the lattice is not unless. So it's only one of the twists of n equals 4 you can do this with. All right. So kind of remarkably, this twisted theory, which was studied by Marcus in 4 dimensions, actually can be rewritten very compactly and as though it lived in 5 dimensions and used to a simple dimensional reduction to go down to the Marcus twist. So in fact, you can get the entire action for the theory from exactly the same form as that 2-dimensional example I gave you before, except these indices now run from 1 to 5, not 1 to 2, except there's an additional Q-closed form that appears in 4 dimensions, which you didn't have access to in 2 dimensions. So what we've just learned, the form we just wrote down for 2 dimensions, is formally exactly what you need to reconstruct this twist of n equals 4 in 4 dimensions. I simply do this, if you want, in 5 dimensions, then do a naive dimensional reduction to produce a couple of scalars from, if you want, A5, naturally. All right. The Q-closed form also looks very simple in this 5-dimensional language. It's just the obvious pairing of 2 chi's together with a d bar c and this epsilon. So this is supersymmetric because when I act with Q on one of these chi's, I get an F bar. And so this is just vanishes by the Bianchi identity. So I get an epsilon D bar F bar. So this is supersymmetric without being Q exact. But the other piece is just the same as we had in 2 dimensions formally. So everything I said in 2 dimensions goes through just the same for n equals 4. This is an extremely compact way of writing n equals 4, by the way. And as far as I know, it wasn't even known in the continuum before we used it for these lattice constructions. At least I've not found any reference to it. Okay. It's also intriguing that it seems to want to live in 5 dimensions, of course, but nothing more to say about that. Come on, wake up. Okay, so just one slide showing you how you translate this to the lattice. So I have 5 complex gauge fields in this twist to deal with. So naturally, I would like a lattice with 5 equivalent linearly dependent basis vectors. And such a lattice exists in 4 dimensions. It's called the A4 star lattice. So I basically take an equilateral hypertetrahedron in 4 dimensions. I sit at the center and I draw the 5 vectors out to the corner points. Those vectors plus their negatives give you, translated in all directions, define the lattice. Okay. And so you just put the fields on that lattice in the way you did in 2 dimensions. So the U lives on a link between x and x plus mu a.
Can you describe this lattice again?
So I take the way I think about it, there's lots of ways of talking about it. It's the same as the fundamental weight lattice of SU5, I think. Mm-hmm. But the way I think about it is you take a hypertetrahedron, an equilateral four simplex.
Yes.
So I sit at the center of the 4 simplex and I draw the vectors out to the 5 corner points. Mm-hmm. So those vectors plus their negatives translated appropriately, generate the lattice. So it's a very special lattice. And so notice this construction not only selects the way you gauge the theory and how you deal with the fermions, it even defines the best lattice for you. You don't have a free choice of lattice here. The lattice is also constrained.
The basis comes naturally out of Red J calculus also.
It's quite a natural basis for many constructions. Right, right, absolutely. So, but the prescription for the lattice fields is just what I said before. The U's live on links, the basic links. Eta lives at the site. The psi's live on the same links because they're super partners of the U's. And the chi's live on an analog of this diagonal link, which is going from x plus mu a plus mu b back down to x. So it has the opposite orientation to these. That's something I didn't emphasize before. The chi's are taken to have the opposite orientation to the, say, the psi's. So as soon as you go to a lattice, you have two choices of orientation on a link. And the theory is, it matters for gauge invariants which orientation you choose. So since we choose the u's to be oriented from x to x plus mu a, the psi's have to be the same because they're super partners, but I have a free choice of the chi's. Since the chi's contract with the f's, it's natural to take them with the opposite orientation, so I get a closed loop when I contract an f with a chi. It's the same rule we used in 2D, I just didn't tell you about it, I forgot to say something. So that's just the same. Everything transforms as a link, and I have a single exact SUSY just like before. And the derivative prescriptions are all the same. You just replace the vectors mu and nu in those older prescriptions by these general vectors mu a. Okay, but they just move you around in the lattice in exactly the same way. All right, so all of it goes. All the technology is immediately useful. From the simple example, can be used right away in four dimensions. What is really remarkable, I thought, is the supersymmetry of the Q closed form. So the Q exact piece is obviously going to be supersymmetric. If I keep Q squared to be zero, then that's going to be obviously the case, just like for 2D. But this new piece we put into 4D, a priori you would have expected would have broken supersymmetry. But it turns out with my definition of curly F and my definition of this forward difference operator, this actually is satisfied identically on any lattice configuration. So the Bianchi identity is exact in this lattice construction, which is certainly not true for lattice QCD. So these discretization prescriptions have something rather beautiful about them in the sense that they preserve exact structures like the Bianchi identity, which you wouldn't have ordinarily expected. So you can just write this out in terms of products of links, and they just all cancel by pairs, just as they would do in the continuum. Okay. So this is because of that, this is also supersymmetric.
Here you have to use some kind of, okay, this extra fifth dimension.
Well, this is just a bookie. This epsilon here is in some sense a bookie device. It tells me how to anti-symmetrize the indices. It's not necessarily the usual thing you would think about as in the continuum. But all this tells me is if I take FBC, which is, remember, DB plus on UC, I operate once more with it according to my rules, with a DA, and then anti-symmetrize on A, B, and C, everything vanishes in pairs. I get these are all just products then of three U's, and when you contract with the epsilon, they just cancel in pairs.
Yes, I'm just asking also about what is the meaning of this translation in the fifth direction?
So you can write the theory down as though it's living in a continuum. You can write it in five dimensions, and then simply do a simple naive dimensional reduction down to four. And then if you want, the A5 becomes the phi bar that appeared in Marcus's twist. So it's just a compact way of writing in the continuum. When we go to the lattice, it seems to have a little bit more significance because it selects out the lattice structure that I want, because I naturally want five basis vectors.
But you don't have to do this extra reduction in the lattice?
Like no, you can actually write this theory down on a hypercubic lattice in four dimensions where the, if you want, the analog of A5, the analog of the fifth direction is just the body diagonal of the hypercube. It breaks a lot of rotational invariance, so it doesn't look a good choice, but you can formally do it. It's not really a problem. So you can make something which looks just exactly like the continuum. But it makes much more sense to stick with the A4 star lattice, which has nice rotational symmetry. And so that's what we do. But
Still, you have to dimensionally reduce at the end, sure.
No, the A4 star lattice lives in four dimensions. So it's just a linearly dependent set of basis vectors.
So the d5 is a linear combination of the
right. So the phi is like the it's like the singlet piece. So you sum over all five basis vectors of psi a, and that gives me the analog of the scalar. Yeah. So it's okay. there's a, Meta does a very nice paper where this is all written out in great detail, how you map between A4 star on the continuum, and how you take kind of a naive continuum expression from your lattice expressions.
So using this D plus instead of just regular D.
Sorry?
You didn't have to do that in the supersymmetric theory, did you?
All right, well, I have to do something, right? I have to come up with this term.
No, I understand. But I mean, you had a definition of what D plus was in terms of the U's.
In terms of any field, right?
Acting on any field. But if you defined your F's, even in a non-supersymmetric, just in lattice GCT, using...
You could do this.
Then your Bianchi identities would have been automatically satisfied.
Right.
Why don't people just do that?
It's a good question. Well, the reason you'll see that actually, when this, if you remember, the action involved an F bar F or an F dagger F, right? When you work those terms out, you get the Wilson-Plaquette term plus a bunch of pieces which all vanish if the U's are unitary, which they usually are in QCD. So you could use this prescription in QCD. You could write the action as basically F dagger F, and it would boil down to the Wilson-Plaquette. And since all most lattice QCD practitioners care about is the final result, they wouldn't, you know, they don't usually worry about it. But you're right, you could have done this independent of supersymmetry, and it would be a smart thing to do on reflection, since you have the exact Bianchi identity, right? Oh, you have to be in the adjoint, so all fields have to be in the adjoint, but that's true, yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, that's right. Okay, so let me summarize this part of the talk. Contrary to sort of the usual folklore, lattice theories with some supersymmetry are possible. In particular, in four dimensions, n equals 4 seems to be the unique solution to all the constraints. If you want to gauge symmetry and you want at least one exact supercharge, the only theory we know about where we can make these constructions is n equals 4. The lattice action I told you about was originally derived by orbifolding methods by David and Mittat. They were coming at it from a completely different direction. We were focused on discretization of topologically twisted theories. We end up on the same action. So there's some uniqueness to this final end product, if nothing else, we think. So it's much easier to talk about topological twisting than it is to talk about overfolding, in my view. So that's what I'm presenting it as. But historically, the action for n equals 4 was first written down using orbifold methods, actually. It's interesting that this one exact SUSY is already enough to ensure this moduli space survives to all orders in perturbation theory. So last year, we did a calculation where we showed this explicitly. So when you expand around the moduli space at one loop, you'll find that the bosonic and fermionic fluctuations cancel exactly around an arbitrary point in the moduli space, just like they do in the continuum. Since you're computing basically the effective action, it's a topological invariant, so that survives to all orders because of the topological structure. So you can so semi-classical analysis is exact. So this is true. There are some subtleties which I don't have time to talk about today, which we've been worrying about for the last year or so, especially if you think about doing simulations. You have to, in practice, add a gauge invariant potential to freeze the trace mode of the scalar fields. So you're in UN, and your scalars, and you so use a, there's a trace mode of the scalar field. Now, in the naive continuum limit, that mode decouples, but it destabilizes the simulations unless you freeze it at some canonical value. So to do that, you have to add something like this, and give it a VEV directly, and you have to worry about how that changes some of the conclusions associated with exact supersymmetry. I'm not going to talk about that. It has a nice feature that it also regularizes the regular flat directions in the theory. And most continuum calculations end up adding an infrared regulator to n equals 4 anyway, so it's somehow related to the same thing. There's no sign problem at the moment in this theory, and we have some theoretical as well as numerical arguments as to why that is. That means you can do Monte Carlo simulation. If you don't know what a sign problem is, and don't worry about it. But it's related to the fact the partition function in this lattice theory is a topological invariant. We're busy looking at the phase diagram of any of this lattice model right now, but I won't say anything more about that either. So applications are clearly the most obvious one that strikes you is holography. If we have a discrete regularization for n equals 4, we can do non-perturbative tests of ADS-CFT, for example. Except that for us, finite n and finite Tuft coupling are trivial. They're the easy limits. In fact, we don't want to be at infinite n, right, from the point of view of doing numerical simulations. So in principle, this allows us to think about string classical and quantum string corrections in to the ADS CFT. And one would hope it would give us some more general insight into the nature of quantum geometry in general, actually. So this has really hardly been touched. We've done a little bit of work in some dimensionally reduced models involving D0 and D1 brains. That's work with Toby Wiseman, which are dual or conjectured to be dual to various low-dimensional Yang-Mills theories. I don't have time to talk about that, but that's let me just say that the correspondence seems to hold well in those limits. But I want to spend a few minutes talking about now is another connection to quantum gravity, which might be interesting to you guys, which is that if you take the n equals 4 theory in three dimensions, regulated in this way I've told you about, it's essentially the same same story, then you can make a mapping of this theory into the usual Chern-Simons theory that's used to describe three-dimensional gravity. And so that's what I'm trying to tell you a little bit about. So I'm sure with this audience, this is largely unnecessary. So
just in case this is a one-sentence answer, what does the twisting correspond to in the dual gravity or supergravity theory?
I do not know. It's something we've worried about. I don't really know. I mean, because it's not clearly the... Right, that's... See, in flat space, you know what you're doing. It's just a change of variables. In curved space, it in general is not. But since you don't... Since the gravity is... Yeah. Let's talk about it afterwards. It's something that's worried me. Right. We're using it only on the Yang-Mills side, I mean, right, where we can think of space as flat. So for us, it doesn't hurt, but... So it doesn't have to be a correlate on the gravity side necessarily. But if you go down to small n, you might worry there was some correlate that you had to see on the gravity side.
But let me ask you a different question. If you stay just in the topological sector, what would that correspond to in the
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know. It's a good question. I'm not sure. There are lots of good questions to come up with. Yeah. All right, so just a quick reminder. So Chern-Simons theory, this is an alternative that you can write down in three dimensions. It's just a Yang-Mills action. It's gauge invariant up to boundary terms, blah, blah, blah. Large transformations can quantize this coefficient. It's renormalizable. That's obviously true by power counting. In fact, it's known to be finite. All right? It's independent of the background metric, so it has this topological flavor, and the observables fundamentally correspond to Wilson loops. Right? This is true for any Chern-Simons theory. Three-dimensional gravity can be written as a Chern-Simons theory. That goes back to Witten and probably other people in the mid-80s. You basically write down a Chern-Simons action. You choose the gauge group to be some, for example, in the Euclidean case, to be SO13, which means you can think of these gauge potentials as expanded on, for example, a basis which is commutators of gamma matrices. And you have to you modify the trace operation by essentially tracing with gamma 5 in this representation. So I can write down a Chern-Simons action where I modify the trace to include a gamma 5, and then I just use this as my gauge group. Now, forget about whether that's formally L-defined or whatever in the path integral. Let's just use SO13 as the gauge group. The effect of this funny trace is just to put an epsilon in the group's space. So I have an epsilon A, B, C, D, which contracts the group indices here. If I decompose the fields into two pieces, which I can always do, sort of an SO3 piece and then translations, then you can also decompose the field strengths into two pieces, and you get this structure here. If you plug this decomposition, which is just a change of variables at this point, into the original Chern-Simons action, you'll see that it collapses to this structure, which is the usual 3D general action for general relativity in sort of Palatini formulation. Okay, so this is just a well-known fact. This slide is written for a different audience, really, but anyway. The point is that these things, of course, are the dry binds, so they square to the metric. And this metric is clearly invariant under local SO3 rotations. So the corresponding gauge field is the spin connection. And what you have is here with this... its action is a first-order formulation of GR. If I take the classical equations of motion, which set the field strength to zero, then I just get these two equations. This is the torsion equation. When I solve it, I find omega as a function of E. If I plug that back into the first equation and contract with the inverse of the dry bind, then I just find a constant curvature metric. So this is all very well known, and this is what how you identify this Chern Simons theory, at least classically, with the theory of gravity. Right. You might worry about diffeomorphisms. It's where the heck are these in the Chern Simons theory? There's a nice story here as well. Okay, the original gravity theory is invariant under general coordinate transformations, and you might worry where they are in the Chern Simons theory. Well, they're basically related to this additional gauge symmetry you have associated with the field E mu. So what you can show is that on shell, gauge symmetries are equivalent to coordinate transformations for this theory. So a general diffeomorphism acting on the E's looks like a gauge transformation with this parameter, xi dot A, and a piece proportional to the torsion. So when the torsion vanishes, it's just a gauge transformation. So on flat SO13 backgrounds, gauge invariance is the same as coordinate invariance. That's how it manifests itself. All right. So that's an old story. So let me tell you what the new observation is. So these Chern-Simons are very hard to put on the lattice. Theories are very hard to put on the lattice. Nobody has constructed yet a Chern-Simons theory on the lattice for lots of seemingly technical reasons, but there may be more deep reasons to it. But you can nevertheless, you know the physics of this SO31 Chern-Simons theory of gravity is basically dominated by its moduli space and by this set of topological observables, which are the Polyakov lines. So what I'm going to argue is there is a particular twisted Yang-Mills theory with exactly the same moduli space and exactly the same set of topological observables. Okay. So this is not a theory which naively looks the same as the Chern-Simons theory, but it shares the same topological properties. And it's related to one of these twisted models. Unlike the Chern-Simons theory, this path integral defining the Yang-Mills theory is well defined outside of perturbation theory. In principle, if I use the lattice construction I told you about. But that lattice prescription preserves these key topological features because they're related to Q exactness. So in principle, it gives you a non-perturbative definition, perhaps, of this three-dimensional quantum gravity theory written as Chern-Simons. So let me flesh that out a bit more. So suppose I take my original twisted Yang-Mills model. I told you that was written in terms of a complex field strength curly F. And if you go back many slides now, let's go back to find a action somewhere. You'll see that, I'm in flat space here, but don't worry about that. The moduli space of this theory corresponds to curly F equals 0 and this commutator dd bar being 0. So there are two conditions that define the moduli space. Okay, which are just these things. This is really, when you work this out, it's just the condition that the ordinary covariant derivative on the scalar field contracted over the mu's is 0. All right. So my original Yang-Mills model, now in three dimensions with n equals 4 supersymmetry, has this moduli space. And this, of course, these solutions are only good modulo the, I'm going to pick SU2 gauge groups. Okay? So this is the moduli space. The solutions of these equations up to SU2 gauge transformations. The moduli space of this three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory is just F equals 0 modulo SL2C transformations, because this is the SO31. All right? Now, what Marcus argued in his actual paper about N equals 4 is, in fact, these two moduli spaces are likely the same. He has a semi-rigorous proof of this statement in the case of N equals 4. Right. You can think of this as just like an additional gauge condition. So if you start with here, and then you fix out the imaginary gauge transformations with a Feynman gauge on the imaginary part of the connection like this, then you can see that this is not unrelated to this, that these two are the same. So this is the statement that the moduli space of these equations is meant to be the same as this moduli space.
Sorry, when you say moduli space, you just mean set of solutions?
Set of solutions up to gauge transformations. In this case, it's SU2. In this case, it's the complexified SU2. Right. So the statement is that these two moduli spaces are the same. And there is a proof, which I think is not actually rigorous, by Marcus of this statement, which is from the mid-90s. So that's one thing. So at least there's an argument the two moduli spaces are the same. In addition, if you remember, A bar was annihilated by my BRST charge in the twisted Yang-Mills case. So exponentials of A bar Polyakov lines built in terms of A bar are topological observables in the twisted Young-Mills theory. So they will be good topological observables in this. So they will have VEBs, which are metric independent and independent of the coupling constant, just as the same things do in the Chern-Simons gravity case. So remember, this is the complexified connection that appears here. So it's the same connection that appears inside of here. So in the Chern-Simons theory, the claim is that the topological observables are Wilson loops corresponding to this gauge group. In the twisted Young-Mills theory, there are also topological observables which look formally exactly the same. They involve the full complexified SU2 group. That's what goes into them. They are topological for very different reasons. They're topological now because they're annihilated by Q. Right? There's no analog of Q in the usual Chern-Simons theory. So this starts off with the Young-Mills model has to be formulated in some background metric, but the topological observables you prove are not dependent on that metric for this reason. Of course, in this case, the argument is slightly different. In this case, they are manifestly topological from the outset. These are the only observables you can have. All right. So the claim is that since the moduli spaces are meant to be the same, and since the set of topological observables are actually the same, these two theories must in some sense be equivalent. Which means that I can use in principle my twisted Young-Mills model as a representation, if you want a recipe, for computing the vacuum expectation values of topological observables in the three-dimensional Chern-Simons theory of gravity. And if you accept that's actually the theory of quantum gravity, then that statement goes all the way through. Furthermore, I've just given you a prescription for discretizing this, which preserves the Q invariants. So that would now be a discrete representation, computable representation, that would allow you to compute, in principle, vacuum expectation values of Polyakov lines in the three-dimensional Chern-Simons gravity theory. So that's the statement. This is not a rigorous statement, but at least all the pieces are there for that to hold. So metric independence is much more subtle in this formulation of the model. It relies on this existence of this twisted supersymmetry, whereas it sort of manifests in the Chern-Simons theory because there is no background metric needed to contract the indices.
Is this only the Chern-Simons theory that corresponds to gravity without a topological?
Well, it has to be a complexified SUN theory. So it naturally maps to the SU2 twisted theory.
Right. So I don't remember exactly how it goes.
If you wanted to write down a Chern-Simons theory with any that corresponded to a complexified SUN group, it would be true.
Right. But if you turn on a cosmological constant, it's no longer SO3-1, it's SO2-2.
Right. So that won't work. So it has to be Euclidean. Right. I mean, I think of the SO3-1 as Euclidean de Zitter or something like that. Or not Euclidean anti-de-Zitter, something like that, right?
Okay, so you just get one of those.
Yeah. The twisting process requires that you're in Euclidean space. I mean, that's one of the inputs to it. If you think about twisting the flavor group with the rotation group, it has to be an SO. So it shouldn't be surprising that the only gauge symmetry you can match to is essentially a Euclidean version, if you want, of ADS or something like that. Yeah. So again, it's not a universal prescription, at least naively. Right. But it's certainly true that any Chern-Simons theory written for a complexified UN group would have this mapping, not just the SU2 theory. It's just so that's the one that has application maybe to gravity. Right.
Just there's a question here that, yeah. Let's say if the, you know, in the continuum, the bundle is non-trivial. If the bundle is trivial, then Chern-Simons action vanish on share.
Right.
Which is the
but you can put twists into the field.
The twisting case.
Yeah.
But so if you're on a non-trivial bundle, then it does not. So does that mean that in some sense it corresponds to a particular trivial bundle? I mean, I know that in the lattice, I'm not sure how people describe non-trivial bundles or if it's.
Well, you can do non-trivial boundary conditions in lattice. There is, it's not really a problem. You can put twists in the gauge group as you go around the, say, suppose you start off on a torus spanned by this particular lattice, and then as you cross the boundary, you do a little twist. That's, and so for that way, you could build in non-trivial VEBs for the Polyakov lines, in principle. I don't see an obstruction to doing that. And then the statement is those vevs would be independent of the coupling constant and would correspond presumably to the same things you would compute in the continuum in an arbitrary background metric, and it would presumably correspond to the Chern-Simons vevs. But I mean, I haven't done anything practical with any of this, but I think in principle it's, there's no obstruction to that. So you, I mean, you could.
But here the remark is that if these two theories are equivalent, they are going to be equivalent only if the Chern-Simon theory is on a trivial number.
Right.
Because the twisted action is always zero, unchecked, which is not the case for. So the twisted action on shell is zero, vanish, when you put f equals zero.
Yes, but it can't do if you play with the boundary conditions.
Okay, so you
so that's only a local state. Just as normally, this is only a local statement, right? Yeah. If you do something funny with the boundaries, this cannot be true globally, just as it is in the that cannot be true for the Chern-Simons theory globally, right?
It's because the action is f squared, so if f vanish, f squared vanish.
Right, but if I put a twist in there, it can't achieve f equals zero everywhere. It doesn't have to do that, right? It can't do that if I put an appropriate boundary condition in. And now it's certainly true that the equivalence to the ordinary Yang-Mills theory is not necessarily the same if you start messing with the boundary conditions. But I'm not interested in that here, right? I mean, I'm over, so I should just wrap up. Okay, so this is just what I was saying. This twisted Susie theory gives an alternative description, perhaps, of Chern-Simons gravity. But the advantage over Chern-Simons is its action is real and positive semi-definite. I have only a compact gauge symmetry, so the measure is well-defined. There's no problem with unitarity. Like, there's usually people worry about non-compact gauge groups and what it means to integrate over them. It doesn't even come into the Yang-Mills theory. You can have a lattice formulation, so you can make this a statement in principle true outside of perturbation theory. And so in that sense, it may give you an alternative non-perturbative definition of what you mean, at least by Chern-Simons gravity. And whether you mean that's everything about gravity, I don't know, but it's certainly Chern-Simons gravity. That's just the ingredients. I was just going to finish off with one slide saying, you know, where you might go with some of this stuff, and none of this is worked out, but just threw it in for fun. So, these Chern-Simons formulations of gravity, of course, exist in any odd dimension. That's been known for a long time. So, for example, in five dimensions, you can take traces of A with F, the appropriate number of times, to give you a Chern-Simons theory. You might wonder whether this has some connection to a twisted five-dimensional theory. Remember, it looks like this N equals 4 theory wants to live in five dimensions. There are obvious ways to try to complete that N equals 4 theory. And then you could worry about the connections between those things. That hasn't been done, and it may be impossible, but it's sort of an intriguing idea. It's also possible to reuse some of these funny lattices that came up in the supersymmetric constructions. So, for example, if I go to five dimensions, there's an A5 star lattice, which is the natural analog of A4 star. And then I can take products of U variables in such a way that the sum of all these basis vectors, 1, A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, E and F, all add up to zero. That's the definition. So this is, although it looks like a product of U variables in a line, it's actually a closed loop. So this is a candidate lattice action, which has sort of Chern-Simons-like qualities, because it involves an epsilon tensor, and it's gauge invariant locally. All right? If you look at the naive continuum limit of this thing, it looks something like F, and then a D-phi when I do a... because one of these, I have six basis vectors. So one of them is redundant, right? And the corresponding A gives you a scalar field in the naive continuum limit. So this theory actually looks like, not exactly like a Chern-Simons theory, it looks like F, F, D, phi, when I actually construct this thing. So if you want, that freezes one of those indices. So if I can integrate that by parts in the naive continuum limit, this looks like an integral over the boundary of phi, F, wedge, F, which of course has connections to McDowell-Mansouri gravity on the boundary. So it's possible that by simulating, for example, something like this theory in five dimensions, based on this A5 star lattice, you may get some connection not to Chern-Simons theories, but to theories like this, which live on the boundary. Suppose I take a lattice which has some boundaries, some finite, you know, it's not just a torus, but has, you know, free boundary conditions. You might have some... you might be able to make some connection to things like McDowell-Mansouri gravity. So this is not a direct consequence of supersymmetry. This is just reusing one of these lattices that seem to come very naturally out of the supersymmetric constructions. So again, that hasn't been done, but it's an obvious thing to think about. And this would be, if you want a numerical project, one would stick a this sort of lattice in five dimensions, and one would simulate this type of action, and then you would leave boundary conditions appropriately on the edges of the lattice so that you could hope that you were getting something like this induced on the boundary. So that would be your four-dimensional gravity action. All right, that's it. Thanks.